News Radio, I'm Carl Lamar.
America, drowning in information, starving for wisdom. The Kate Daly Show starts now.
You can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path. And that will make all the difference. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. You've got to find what you love, and that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle. Have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become.
Hi there. Welcome to the Kate Daly Show. Wow, we have a good Wednesday for you. I'm not kidding. Today's going to be a great show. And I have Melissa Smith on with me. How are you, Melissa?
I'm good.
Excellent. We're going to be talking. That was Steve Jobs' commencement speech in 2005, and I think it was titled "How to Live Before You Die." And Steve Jobs passed away, and that speech is very. It's a really interesting speech. I don't know why he didn't mention God. But it's a very interesting speech, and I there were parts that I really, really liked. In fact, graduation speeches, we were just talking to Pesta about this, Dr. Duke Pesta on Monday about this, and he's going to come out with his own graduation speech, because you're going to notice, and I just got an email from somebody in media that was telling me, Kate, it's kind of interesting how you're not seeing hardly any conservative speakers out there give good messages. You're seeing the Tim Cook from Apple. You're seeing the, telling everybody that the generation has failed them because they didn't work on climate change. Give me a break. What a farce. And so all of these things, all we're seeing are these speeches by liberals and the messages they're giving. And so Melissa's going to take us down. This is so fascinating to me. And I love that you did this, Melissa. So hats off to you. But you went through some of our older commencement speeches, because this is what we tell our youth as they're about to embark on the world. And I want to know in history what happened. What happened to the graduation speech? This is so good. And then at the end of this hour, we're going to talk about three things in history that will make you think differently about the world we live in. So I can't wait to get there, too. Let's take off with graduation.
Yeah, let me preface all of this by telling you that Indiana University, their commencement speaker this year was Samantha Power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have it on good authority by those that were there, that it was such a mediocre speech, and they came away from the whole thing thinking, she's really average.
she's a little loony too, but go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it just made me really mm-hmm. think about, why her?
Right.
Apparently she was hawking a book. She's written a book. And my friend who's also written a book was kind of mad about that. Like, yeah, they're going to buy her book, but mm-hmm. I have better things to say because she's really mediocre.
Sure.
Anyway, I went back and read a selection of commencement talks or portions of commencement talks. The earliest one that I read went back all the way to 1774.
Whoa.
Yeah, by a man named Barnabas Binney, speaking at Rhode Island College, which is now Brown University.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting because we think that now 1774, this is before the American Revolution.
Right.
What is he worried about? What would you suspect would be on his mind? I mean, he's in New England, right at the crucible of revolutionary fervor.
Sure, sure.
He is very concerned about religious liberty.
I'll bet. Oh, wow.
Isn't that interesting?
Of course. Of course he would be. It's the only reason they fled here. Not the only reason, but the biggest reason is why they even took the boat, the risk, and fled. So, yes, I do believe it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And many years ago, I took a course in graduate school on American intellectual history. And what I think is really interesting is how closely these commencement orations parallel the general trends in intellectual history. So in the revolutionary period, when you would expect people to be concerned about issues of freedom and liberty and not rebellion so much, but mm-hmm. about protecting their rights, that's exactly what you get from Barnabas Binney. He's talking about, you know, his corroborated by the fatal consequences of its prohibition or abridgment and the glorious effects of its protection or toleration, so abundantly evident in the history of every age and nation, both ecclesiastic and civil. This is rough going, and the language alone is kind of tough to go back to 1774. Here's one of the great quotes that he has. He says, "Does the enjoyment and security of her religious right less merit her attention than her civil? Or are they not so nearly allied that a deprivation of the former in any degree is an absolute encroachment on the latter?"
Wow.
So he's saying any encroachment on religious liberty is an encroachment on our civil liberties.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish someone would say that at commencement today.
And they won't say it so eloquently and in the way that he did. We've dumbed it down so bad. So I hear the commencement speeches now, and it's surprising to me because I'm listening to the language he just used to give that commencement speech. And I think our kids today would be lost. What did he say?
Well, I will have to tell you that, like I said, I took an intellectual history class. And it was one of the most difficult courses that I ever took in college because we were reading original source documents that were written in the 1770s right. and in the 1830s and in the 1850s. And they did not speak the way we do now.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure.
There was a different intellectual level.
Well,
so
here's a question
really
for you.
I was kind of impressed that he was very concerned about religious liberty.
Well,
something that we're equally concerned about today.
Exactly.
Still.
But are you hearing about that in any? I haven't heard about that. I've heard climate change. I've heard other things, but I'm not hearing a ton about that in commencement speeches today. But even though it is always headline news, national, I mean, it's consistently in the headlines, especially this year, I've noticed. But isn't that kind of amazing that I haven't picked up on that yet in the commencement speech given at college like it was in 1774? Interesting.
Well, and I think if when we get into the more modern commencement speeches, I think you're going to see a sea change in what our universities are preoccupied with,
mm-hmm.
what their concerns are,
and
that's the intellectual history of the United States. What are we worried about today? What are we encouraging our young people? What are the fights we want them to fight? What are the things mm-hmm. we want them to think about as they embark on really their adult careers?
So what's the next one? When you went to 1774, what time period did you go to next?
1838.
Okay.
With Ralph Waldo Emerson. Now, Emerson was a great thinker. He was famous in his day, very, mm-hmm. very well known.
Mm-hmm.
He was speaking, this is a divinity school address from Divinity College, Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
Equally difficult to read. I have never really cared for Emerson. He's very complicated speaker and writer. What he was concerned about was the phase that comes after the Revolutionary period, and you've heard quotes from the founders about this.
Yeah.
They were very concerned about virtue.
Yes.
We had to have a virtuous republic
in order to maintain
republican ideals.
I agree.
That's R with a little R.
Mm-hmm.
And so his whole talk here is about, in specific, Christian virtue. Now, he's speaking to a divinity college, so you would assume that that might be the case. But it's a very, the whole middle section, and it's a very lengthy oration. I did not read all of it because the whole middle chunk, he takes what he considered modern Christianity of his day to task for all of the things that they were not doing and the way they were not feeding the soul and the spirit and the virtue of the people and blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And he goes on for page after page after page of it.
Interesting.
But here's what he has to say about virtue. He says, a more secret, sweet, and overpowering beauty appears to man when his heart and mind open to the sentiment of virtue. Then he is instructed in what is above him. He learns that his being is without bound, that to be good, to be perfect, he is born, low as he now lies in evil and weakness. That which he venerates is still his own, though he has not realized it yet. He ought. He knows the sense of the grand word, though his analysis fails entirely to render account of it. When in innocency or when by intellectual perception he attains to say, I love the right, truth is beauty within and without forevermore. Virtue, I am thine, save me, use me, thee I will serve day and night in great and small, that I may not be virtuous but virtue. Then is the end of the creation answered and God is well pleased.
Wow. Something you would not hear in a speech today. Very interesting.
I don't think most of our college graduates could even understand what he said.
Probably not.
Really and truly. I mean,
you're probably right. You're probably right.
Yeah. But he's just talking about, you know, looking inside yourself and answering the call of God to be not virtuous, but virtue. To be the embodiment of virtue in your life.
Boy, that's interesting.
Who calls our graduates to do that?
They don't. They don't. It's seek after and go grab and go get and things like that. And there's some other things too that they've mentioned, like we talked about with Tim Cook. But that is unique. And you couldn't do that speech today. That's really quite sad. And so basically, instead of using it as a verb as part of your life, he's saying embody it completely. Embody virtue completely. Okay.
He goes on to say the sentiment of virtue is a reverence and a delight in the presence of certain divine laws.
Mm.
How many of us even think about, I would bet if we ask 100 people on the street to tell us what virtue even is, we would not know.
I think you're right about that. I don't think we know how to define it. We don't talk about it. So how in the world would we ever define it? Be right back on the Kate Daly Show. More with Melissa when we come back.
There you go.
How would you like to participate?
Lines are open now. Call 888-673-1450. This is the Kate Daly Show.
I love going back through history and taking a look in context at what we have today compared to yesteryear and then understanding where we've come from and how far we've come, sometimes not in a great direction, but nonetheless, how far we've come. And Melissa's doing a stellar job of that. Melissa, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
You betcha. That song is very interesting. You have kids in school band, and so I'm sure that song is played. The Pomp and Circumstance song, it was actually written 1902 for the British King's coronation of Edward, and its name is a Shakespeare reference. The name is a Shakespeare reference, which is kind of interesting, isn't it, that it was kind of a reference to a passage from Shakespeare, Othello.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is probably the most recognizable of all of Elgar's pieces of music. Even he's got some other well-known music, but
not like
everybody
that.
Knows that. Everybody.
They've been playing it since the early 1900s, and the first school to do it was Yale, and then University of Chicago and Columbia chimed in and started doing it, and then everybody started doing it. So you're going to hear that again and again over the next couple of weeks, I'm sure, depending on what state you live in. But It's interesting. I always find that part of his, we're so intertwined with Britain. It's not even funny. But I always look at this kind of stuff and think, wow, that's where that came from. And I always like to know history. But there was an end to the speech that you were referencing from the early to mid 1800s by Ralph, right?
By Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yes.
Yeah. He wraps up all of this. He's talking about, you know, what can we do to kindle the fires? And he says, rather let the breath of new life be breathed by you through the forms already existing. Then he tells them what forms he sees that we can breathe the life of virtue into people. The first one, he says, two inestimable advantages Christianity has given us. First, the Sabbath, the jubilee of the whole world whose light dawns welcome alike into the closet of the philosopher, into the garret of toil, and into prison cells, and everywhere suggests, even to the vile, the dignity of spiritual being. That's kind of interesting. I thought it welcomed the coming of the NFL, but maybe not.
Yeah.
And then he says, let it stand, meaning let the Sabbath day stand forevermore a temple.
He talked about the Sabbath day in his speech.
Yeah, that the Sabbath was the day welcomed by everyone, no matter what your circumstance was.
Wow.
And secondly, the institution of preaching, the speech of man to men, essentially the most flexible of all organs, of all forms. What hinders that now everywhere in pulpits, in lecture houses, in lecture rooms, in houses and fields, wherever the invitation of men or your own occasions lead you, you speak the very truth as your life and conscience teach it and cheer the waiting, fainting hearts of men with new hope and new revelation. I find that to be kind of inspiring, actually.
Sure. Yeah.
If we were more conscious of our speech and our language between each other, and we were on the journey to inspire others and inspire them with truth,
right,
where would we be? We would be in a different place, I think.
Yeah, we would. Absolutely.
The next one I read that I thought was very interesting came from 1947. This is right at the end of World War II. And once again, it was a Harvard University commencement speech given by George Marshall. And it was where he announced the Marshall Plan.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Well, it truly was.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And he is telling the graduates that they don't fully understand what has happened in Europe and the economic situation, and they need to concern themselves with the cares of the world and how to fix this. And I can understand that. I mean, given what had happened after World War I, they did not want a repeat of that. And so here's George Marshall at Harvard talking about the rehabilitation of Europe, the physical loss of life, the visible destruction of cities, factories, mines, railroads, was correctly estimated, but it has become obvious during recent months that this visible destruction was probably less serious than the dislocation of the entire fabric of the European economy.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that it really wasn't intended to help foreign countries, but it was sold that way. And so I find it interesting that he sold it in a commencement speech first, because I know Jeffrey Tucker had written about the Marshall Plan to a great extent. I've had him on the show. And he said, you know, what was the point of the Marshall Plan? It was named after General George Marshall, but it was well described in the works of historians and so forth that Marshall played a role of a patsy, sort of delivering a prepackaged speech, you know, and then his original pitch given at Harvard was for money to end hunger, poverty, desperation, chaos. But the real upshot of the Marshall Plan was a political maneuver to basically get the taxpayers on board to help influential America on the government dole, you know, and kind of get a little bit more intertwined with the companies. And so the plan, the legacy, was pretty egregious, but it was a perpetual use of foreign aid. That's what it set up. And it was just like we do now. Is that money helping other countries? I'm not sure it is, but I'm going to go with probably not. It's probably ransom money to become friends with them so that we can, they'll bank with us and what have you. But I always thought that was kind of an interesting part of our history was the Marshall Plan, because I do think a lot of people think it saved a lot of things, but actually I think it was sold as that and something different. Kind of interesting.
Well, he says in this address that he's asking for 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's not what actually happened.
No.
But he felt, at least in this speech he is presenting, we have to do something in the short term.
Yeah.
But what is the intellectual shift that's happened? Mm-hmm. We're less concerned about the individual's virtue, about personal righteousness, about going out into the world and being a force for evil in your personal life.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about the politics of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to be a player on the international stage. We want you to go out and participate with us in this great rebuilding effort. Mm-hmm. It's really the harbinger of Cold War thinking.
And globalism.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's that shift in that direction. You would never hear Ralph Waldo Emerson talking about the poor plight of the people of Poland or the people of Ireland who were starving in the potato famine.
Because we were already going through our own plight, and that was recovering from a war. And so it's interesting that the Marshall Plan came along and got kind of sold like that, because it really was, you know, with the establishment of the UN in this decade and so many things that pointed toward globalism now, it's interesting that he was turning the students on to globalism, whereas Emerson in the 1800s was making them very aware of themselves and the virtue that they would embody to be the best, not only patriots, but to also be the very best people they could be. It's kind of interesting. Parallel.
He says the whole world of the future hangs on a proper judgment. It hangs, I think, to a large extent on the realization of the American people of just what are the various dominant factors, what are the reactions of the people, what are the justifications of those reactions, what are the sufferings, what is needed, what can best be done, what must be done.
Yeah.
That's the conclusion of his speech. There's no go out there and be a good person or do right in the world. It's what do you as a cog in the machine need to do to bring, to do right in the world.
Yeah. At the same time, by the way, remember the Committee for Economic Development was formed in 1942, and that was the think tank, too, that delivered to this deal as well their ideas about globalism, along with the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR. So they really had themselves positioned in that way. So that speech given is very interesting to me, because I that was the dawn. That was the dawn of embrace this, you know. Don't think about America. Think about it globally.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, the next one that I read, believe it or not, and I picked this one out just because I was a fan back in the day, was the 1994 commencement address at the Berklee School of Music by Sting, the musician from The Police.
Okay.
And I actually really enjoyed, of all the commencement speeches that I read, I enjoyed his the most.
Interesting.
Why is that? Like I said, I was a fan. I have full disclosure. I was a fan of The Police back in the day. But he talks about what he calls the mystery of music and how he came to be a musician. He talks a little bit about that, but he says music is an addiction, a religion, and a disease, and there is no cure, no antidote. I was hooked.
Wow.
I have a family of musicians here, and I can tell you that there is a certain truth in that.
Sure.
He also goes on to say, I thought this was particularly moving. He says, musicians aren't particularly good role models in society. We really don't have a very good reputation. Philanderers, alcoholics, addicts, alimony jumpers, tax evaders. And I'm not just talking about rock musicians. Classical musicians have just as bad a reputation, and jazz musicians forget it. But if you watch a musician play, when he enters that private musical world, you often see a child at play, innocent and curious, full of wonder and what can only be adequately described as a mystery, a sacred mystery even, something deep, something strange, both joyous and sad, something impossible to explain in words. I mean, what could possibly keep us playing scales and arpeggios hour after hour, day after day, year after year? Is it some vague promise of glory, money, or fame, or is it something deeper?
Hmm.
And I thought that was a beautiful expression of what art is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's something inside of us. And he offers them some interesting advice. These and Berklee School of Music, obviously, everyone in the audience, they were all embarking on a music career. But he tells us that music is probably the oldest religious rite there is. And I would agree with that, that that's probably true. He says the first priests were probably musicians.
Hmm.
And it has a very, just like Ralph Waldo Emerson, just like the earlier 1774 speaker,
uh-huh.
It has a very religious overtone to it, which I didn't expect to come from Sting.
Well, yeah, that's kind of surprising.
He talks about the sacredness of the silence.
Hmm. Interesting.
And that is music really... Is what affects us in music really the silence
mm-hmm.
between the sound?
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's very, he gave a very profound, I thought, and very inspiring kind of thing, like mm-hmm. to think about it. It was unexpected that he would be, yeah. And it's not a conventional religiosity.
Mm-hmm.
He's not preaching Christian religion, but he's preaching about those things that mm-hmm. are very heartfelt
hmm.
and deep in our souls.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was, thanks for that. I was looking at something, that said, you know, of the graduation speeches, these are the ones that hit home. And that was when somebody talked about the importance of goals or taking responsibility for your actions, using mistakes to build a future, citing Thomas Edison and finding inspiration, what motivates you, what influences you, never give up, creating a personal code, the golden rule, doing unto others. And how the past shapes us and what to focus on, what would be your focus in the future. I still would love to see more on virtue and character and, you know, all of those things too. But these are all parts of that. So, but it is kind of interesting to see how the speeches do change through the years. And so we went from, you know, through the decades with you and through that time period and ended up in music, which is, music is universal. I'll give them that. I think it's great. I think it's kind of interesting, the parallels that were just drawn and what we can learn from what was spoken about. Be right back on The Kate Daly Show. Good job. We'll be right back.
Need help establishing...
All right, there's a reason. There's a reason I got Melissa on with me. You're live, Melissa. There's a reason I'm playing this. There's a couple of stories in history, and history, you know, fascinates me. I know it fascinates. I know it fascinates you, Melissa, because you majored in it. But I'll tell you,
yeah, I did. I spent a lot of time.
Yeah, I'll tell you, this is. I love this kind of stuff because we can learn so much from our past, and sometimes we just forget these kinds of things. And even if you've learned them, so I always think this is funny. But before we go there, you want to tell real quick to wrap up those last two segments of the show about Bill Gates.
Yeah, Bill Gates spoke at Harvard in 2007, and I was astonished at how very Bill Gates it was.
I'm sure.
It was a whole speech that turned doing charitable good deeds to a political end.
Of course.
And that is like the very definition of Bill Gates.
Yep.
It was rather strange that the talk, you know... I don't know. I think he meant to be inspiring, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I was very inspired by what he had to say.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's always political with him. I don't know why he's
political.
In our healthcare and everything else. He's a computer guy. I think people forget that. So let's talk about bumblebees, because I thought this was kind of fascinating from history. And I want to talk about talking trees, too. But go ahead. This is good.
Well, this is something, believe it or not, I have never, ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
There is a custom called telling the bees.
Mm-hmm.
It's apparently something very old, mm-hmm. Dates long way back in British history, but it was also widely done in New England early in our history. And at the time, you know, back in history, lots of people were beekeepers because mm-hmm. bees are so important to
right.
the eco cycle. Mm-hmm. If you don't have bees, right. then you don't have pollination, and then you don't have what you need. So
they were highly
prized. Lots of people kept bees.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the custom is that whenever someone meaningful has died, you need to go and tell the bees.
That's so interesting to me. So this is in Celtic mythology, kind of where this is rooted. But the bees are the link of what?
They're the messengers to those on the other side. So you go and talk to the bees,
uh-huh.
and they carry your message for
that
you.
That is fascinating. So any message that you wish to pass along, right, who was dead, and all you had to do is tell the bees? And they just passed the message along.
Well, I don't know how long that this was meant to go on,
uh-huh.
but you were at least meant to tell the bees that someone had passed on mm-hmm. so that they could make the connection.
Okay. So telling the bees was who did that in the family? I mean, was it like a job for somebody or the whole family did it or what?
It would be whoever was now the head of the household.
Okay.
If the husband has died, then the wife should go. If the, uh-huh. the wife has died, then the husband should go.
Okay.
I'm sure. I don't know that. Who knows if there was some kind of protocol about it? But
so you knock. Get their attention, and then you murmur the solemn news because you're grieving because somebody just passed away, right? And
right.
and so they would do these little rhymes, which I found kind of interesting. Okay,
and they would even go. Like cover over the hives with a black shroud
mm-hmm.
so that the bees are also in mourning. And it was supposed to be very bad luck if you did not tell the bees
mm-hmm.
or if you did not give them the opportunity to be in mourning or if you sold the hive.
Don't you always wonder like who started doing this and then it caught on? Because there must have been some terrible misfortune, some bad luck that happened to somebody for everybody to believe that they needed to do this. Right.
Well, do you know, from a psychological viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
I just think about maybe I don't go tell the bees because maybe I don't have a beehive in my backyard anymore.
Right.
But I certainly tell my dog a lot of things.
Okay. All right.
You know, and how many people do we know that regard their dogs as members of their family? I'm a mm-hmm. mom dog or a dog mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have these connections to the animals that are significant in our life.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk to them.
Yeah. That's
I think it's there's two things happening here. Number one, the bees were really important
mm-hmm.
to them.
And highly
and number
regarded.
Number two, I think it's psychologically healthy to just express your grief somewhere.
Yeah. It sounds like they were like the deliverer to the spirit world, right? So it's interesting that bees got sort of appointed with that role. That fascinates me because they did have tales, I think, of families that had, say, 17 hives, right? And their keeper died and nobody told them about the death. And so every bee died, which is kind of an interesting tale, because if that really happened, I mean, that would convince you that this was a custom you probably needed to keep up. Right. But what made the bee? Why the bee?
Well, I don't know. And if I put my little hippie mom hat on
mm-hmm.
and I look at the condition of beehives in the world today, what are the bees trying to tell us now?
Oh, yeah.
You know, are they trying to tell us that we don't have a healthy relationship?
Probably.
With them and other aspects of the world? I don't know.
Well,
I'm not really ready to say that bees are actually delivering messages to the other side.
Given the extent, though, of what we're doing to, you know, the minds of men get together and kind of conspire to do things on food supply and soil and farming and everything else that they're trying to do, weed out the farmers. I think there's something, it's kind of like when people do the grounding in the soil, they get barefoot and they go and they put themselves in the soil and it causes what they call grounding. I think that we have lost our history on these kinds of things, but I actually think those things are important, not from a hippie standpoint. I think people will probably think that in a heartbeat, but just because we have become so far removed from understanding our relationship with the earth. When I think about the earth, I think about all that's going on to distort the message, right? To make us, to make the earth replace God. And I don't like that. But I also know that farmers have a very unique and ranchers have a very unique connection to their animals and their land and how much of America that's been a part of. So you have to take all of that into consideration.
Well, we talked about this on another show, another week. I'm a very firm believer in a stewardship kind of concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I am too. We have a responsibility to be wise about the earth. Like you said, it's not a replacement, but it's a thing that God has given us responsibility over, and we should look after the things of the earth.
Right.
And bees they're a very unique part of our whole ecosystem. Without bees, we don't have pollinators, and it's a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah, we've got to get rid of those that are manipulating that whole process, that are putting themselves in that whole process to do things that are so detrimental. And
manipulating the message of that as well.
Yeah, yeah, I'll give you that, for sure.
I'm not going to worship the earth, but I'm going to be reverent about it because it's been entrusted to me.
And you know what's interesting when you say that is when you're kind of reverent about it, when it's something that's meaningful. I think that's where it starts and ends. The manipulation process of human caused global warming and the human caused CO2 is harming us, and all of the messages all come to a profit margin, right? That's what they're trying to do is take money from the taxpayers in order to it's basic extortion for this whole scheme that they've been dreaming up for years and wanting to do this on and have done. But when it's just reverence for the earth, I think that you also come under the same sort of explanation that, you know what, that God made a pretty good one, and it does heal itself. And that's something that our youth are not told, that it does heal itself. And when we're good stewards, we have a really great earth, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the progressive left's message, but everything to do with the fact that it's the recognizing who's really in charge and who made this world. So that's what it is to me.
I think reverencing God's creations is also a way to reverence God.
Yeah, for sure.
And we have, when I look at nature, I kind of marvel at the amazing diversity, and at the beauty of the whole system that's been put in place. And I think we do have a responsibility to look after the things that we've been entrusted
with. Right. Well, you can't drive across the country and not get a tear in your eye when you're looking around at all the beauty. I mean, there's no way to explain it. And there's a total reverence for it. So before we go, I want to talk about talking trees, too, because this is kind of fascinating to me.
Not the talking trees or the crooked trees.
The crooked trees. Yes. Or the statues. Pick one. Because the statues is equally
as interesting. We got to do the trees. We've talked about the bees. We've got to do the trees now.
Go for it.
There's a place in Saskatchewan, Canada, and it's just this very little area where the trees do not grow straight. They grow crooked. And no one knows why they're doing this. It's become now sort of a tourist attraction. There's lots of theories as to why these trees grow this way. Some people have speculated that there was some kind of contaminant from a meteorite that flew in and changed the soil composition. Some people, you know they're out there, right? Said it's aliens.
Yeah.
We all know that has to be part of it.
Right.
But whatever it is, it has affected even the offspring of these trees. If you take the seeds from the trees, the offspring of these crooked trees also grow crooked.
Okay, that's weird. And you know what, though? What a life lesson. So not only with the bees, talking out your grief and finding a good friend or finding out, and also your reverence for sort of the God-created earth, but also the fact that you have that whole scenario. You also have these trees that what? Their offspring grows the same way they do. And so what are we setting up for our children and our youth? What are we depriving them of? What are we causing them to be? I mean, it really is kind of an overall life lesson. Maybe they ought to include this in a commencement speech.
There you go. And I think, it's just like the old, we've heard this stuff a million times.
Yeah.
It's what you speak, it becomes your reality.
Yes, it's who you are.
There's lots of people who now, Deepak Chopra was one of the very first ones to talk about, we can actually change our molecular composition by being negative all the time or by thinking tragic, evil thoughts. I don't know what kind of thoughts trees think.
Right.
But whatever has happened to these trees has changed them at the genetic level.
And they still don't know how or why in that particular area. That's weird. Okay.
That's correct. Okay. So, but I think you're right. The message is we should be very careful about the circumstance and the environment that we raise our children in, we don't want to raise our children to have the same crookedness,
exactly,
perhaps,
yeah,
we have had in our life.
Some stand-up tall trees.
Let's help them to stand tall.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking, too. It's like, stand tall and know who you are in this crazy world that you're about to embark on. And then tell me about statues.
Oh, this is crazy. So statues in Rome, there are, I think it's 6 statues in Rome that they call the talking statues.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened in any society where you don't have a lot of freedom of expression, if you spoke up about a corrupt church leader, you mm-hmm. were not in a good situation. So people would go to these statues, which were kind of gathering places. Maybe you have something to say about a local authority, and you put a piece of paper, you slap it up at the statue,
right,
and in the middle of the night. And then when everybody wakes up in the morning, we all go down there to see what's there.
Mm-hmm.
And despite attempts by the authorities to make people not do this, it kind of spread through Rome. And it got to the point where people, like, one statue was talking to another, meaning somebody over in this neighborhood would put up a message over here, and the statue in the neighboring, you know, neighborhood would respond to that.
Jeez.
It's kind of a really, really slow sort of social media.
Right. I mean, but it was, though. I mean, that was our social media in the past. And that's also kind of intriguing, that what we will devise to communicate with each other. And there are lots of things that we can devise. We don't have to go with what we're handed either. And you can create something, which they did. They created a whole system of communicating their thoughts and viewpoints to each other through statues.
And it was very, they were very witty. They oftentimes wrote little poems that were mm-hmm. sarcastic or very pointed, to the point that the authorities at one point were going to take one of these statues and throw it in the river as punishment.
Wow.
And they decided that it was kind of ridiculous. Why would you punish
right.
a statue?
but you know what? We kick the computer. We want to throw things at the TV. I guess we're no different. But yeah, you take it out on what's in front of you. But I think that's intriguing because of how they had to get those messages out, and that we all have that in us, and what they had to do, what lengths they had to go to. I think that's kind of cool.
Here's a great example of the statues talking. One statue was asked the following question: Pasquino, why has oil gotten so expensive?
Mm-hmm.
And the statue in another neighborhood replied to Pasquino and said, because Napoleon needs it to fry republics and anoint kings.
Oh, roast.
Yeah.
That's good. That is good stuff right there. Oh, I love it. Melissa, thank you for putting a smile on my face today. That's great. All right. I really appreciate you. Thank you so much. And I'll be right back with Susan. Don't go anywhere. And then I want to tackle an issue from a whole different standpoint. So I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.